You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Dapper Bruce Lafitte. Dapper, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me, brother.
Dapper, the show we're talking about is called The Game Is Mine. I love that title, and I think that's from your grandmother, right? Can you tell me a little bit about that title, The Game Is Mine?
Well, growing up, my grandmother always told me, you know, I had to become something in my life. So during my lifespan, I would get into different things, you know, like working, getting different jobs and stuff. So I consider that like a game, you know, a game of life. So when I got in the art game, my grandmother always told me you got to change things up to make it fit you. So when I got in the art game, I came with the idea to say the word the game has changed, which means the artwork has changed over the years. The attitude about doing the artwork has changed over the years. So about 6 or 7 years into the art game, I changed the name from The Game Has Changed to The Game Is Mine. For instance, when I do the artwork, it always reverts back to me. So on the back of the artwork, it always have the materials I use on the back of it and my name on it, because Basquiat and Picasso, they having problems with their work being original. You can't determine what's real and what's fake. But with my work, you always can know what is real about it and that it's not fake about it. And so the game, when the game has changed to the game is mine, which I hold all control of the art that I create, I could determine whether I can go into the museum or the gallery or just go into people's houses and stuff like that. So I have control of this art that I create. So the game is mine.
I like that. So you said over the years, from when you got into the game, as you're saying, it's the game changed until the game became yours.
Yes, sir.
How did the work change over those years? How do you see your work changing? Because now, right, you've been working for a while and you've been showing a lot. How has the work changed from when you started? Do you recognize that person? Do you see like a very certain change in you or the art?
Yeah, both me is a change and the art has changed. Me for example, when I first started doing art at the Katrina, like in 2006, it was just on paper that I got from Walmart, you know, the cheap paper that didn't have no effect in the art world. But over years, like 2-3 years later, I started changing the paper. I started changing the materials I used. I started being able to talk to the people who got the artwork through the text messages. You know, the game is mine. The game has changed. I see you looking. Dapper Bruce Lafitte presents. You know, Taurus the Bull presents. All that wanted to talk to the person that who owns the artwork. So I would have to change for that person wall space. You know, the work started to looking different from the first series to the sixth series. Started looking different from the second to the eighth series. It started looking different where I started losing square blocks around the artwork, changing the name from Bruce Davenport Jr. to Dapper Bruce Lafitte. So everything changed about it. You know, like maybe for 1 year I would do the work and then I would think about, Bruce, what's next? What's next for you? You know, what you going to do? You know, you could change the work, but how you could change people looking at you, get them thinking different about you. So I put different texts in it. I tell them, hi, Mom. I put certain scripture in it where people say, okay, I can relate to that because I need to hear that. Not just to look at the art. I need to listen to what, I need to look at what he's talking about. And, you know, you want that person who got your artwork to always look at your artwork and say, that's one of my favorite artworks, because he's not only just art, it helps me in life, you know. It's like you got to talk to somebody through the artwork. And the best way I could talk to somebody through the artwork was just doing the artwork, you know. My grandparents always say the child should be seen and not heard. So I tried my best to be seen and heard.
I like that. So so let's talk about some of those. There's one in the show called Canal and Carrollton Avenue on a Saturday. And, you know, you talk about, like, what you just said, that you're saying a lot of things. There's a lot of writing in here. There's a lot of people. There's a lot of life going on, but as you said, there can be also a scripture in here and other kinds of writing. Is there something like that in this one? This one looks like I don't see the scripture right away, but I think there is some writing in there as well, right? Does this kind of have its own story? Because there does seem to be like some writings around the stores there or things that are happening inside there.
Yeah, but that one on Canal and Carrollton is dealing with the Endymion Parade. The Endymion Parade in New Orleans, it rolls on Saturday. And so on Saturday night, a lot of people from uptown and downtown will go to that area. White people, black people, Mexicans, Chinese, they will go to that area, and you'll be freaked out how these people all get along with one another. You say, man, hold on, I'm in the South, and all these white people and black people and Chinese people, they're getting along, they're talking and having a good time, you know. So I wanted to show the people that in the South, before Katrina, you know, you had people getting along, you know. Even though they were different color, they always got to that one spot in that parade, they got along. You didn't see no fighting, nobody humbugging, nobody killing or nothing. You saw people just getting along. And so things that I witnessed as a child, I wanted to demonstrate that. That Canal and Carrollton was one of the epic parades in New Orleans that I wanted to show to the people of the world about the people in New Orleans. We're not savages or nothing. You know, but we just like every other city, you know, we have a crime and stuff like that, but we do have people that try to get along in New Orleans, and I wanted to show that. I wanted to show New Orleans that was getting along.
And in the other paintings in this show, is that also part of what's happening? We see crowds in the street. Is it about the community that some of these are about, the people getting along, as you're saying?
Yes, sir. It was about, there's another one, Canal and Claiborne. That's the Endymion Parade. It would come down Canal Street and it would cross a big street in New Orleans called Claiborne. And on top of that, that's the interstate, the I-10 interstate, and that parade would cross under that. And you would have a lot of people that would come out the Iberville Project, out the Lafitte Project, and out the Callao Project, St. Thomas and Melfamine Project. They all would land there. And you will see a lot of different projects and different neighborhoods all getting that area and just get along. You know, you see people having fun talking about things and stuff. And then when a good band would pass, you see all the people just gravitate to that. It was like a split second. It was no racism. It was like a split second. It was no crime. A split second. It was no arguments. It was no disputes. It was like all everybody was getting along. Because when I was coming up as a child in the 70s and the 80s, it was like my uncles would take me to different parts of the city, and you would see the stuff going on. You'd be like, okay, this is nice. But then at nighttime, you know, it was all changed. It would change up. So I just wanted to show New Orleans in a good time, you know, in a good space for itself before it changed.
And what did change at night? You said, you know, your uncles would take you around and show you the city, and that was during the day. Where everybody got along, as you're saying, it almost sounds like a picture of world peace, right? But then you're saying at night everything changed.
Yeah, at night the freaks would come out at night. You know, it was like a certain time of the day. The good people would have to be inside, so the crazy people would come out and do their thing. You know, that's a crime element would come out. You know, so like people who were dealing with certain things, they come out, sell their goods or do whatever. At nighttime, and hurry to get back inside, you know, before they get too bad. New Orleans started getting bad, like maybe the early 80s when that crack came into the project and all that. Then people who never had money, who were getting money, they became obsessed with it and greedy with it. And sometimes they would have to kill each other off the whole territory or maybe play that UCIC foolishness, you know. And they would kill up each other, you know, and that's what that dark cloud would hang over New Orleans. So people were like, I'm not going to New Orleans because they're killing people. I'm not dealing with New Orleans because they're savages. I'm not dealing with New Orleans for some project. You know, they got crazy people in it. So I wanted to show. I wanted to show the people that, okay, in the daytime, this is what was happening in New Orleans. You got the Indians running through, the parades running through, the second lines running through. But at nighttime, midnight, you better go up in the streets. Get off the street.
right. So that was quite a way to grow up. So you know, growing up in that kind of you know that culture, that there's both danger and then the beauty of of the daytime. That's part of what's formed you as an adult. These are the stories that you're telling in a way.
Right, right. Well, when I was coming up, my grandparents, my grandmother and grandfather, they grew up out of the country. My grandmother from Bunker, Louisiana. My granddad from Jackson, Mississippi. So they were dealing with segregation. They were dealing with Jim Crow. They were dealing with Medgar Evers, Martin Luther King, the March on Washington and stuff. But my granddaddy always would tell me, he said, as a boy, when I was your age, he said, I couldn't do what you're doing now. He said, but you got a chance to be something. You know, he was explaining to me how he couldn't go into the front door. He was explaining to me the color water. He was explaining to me how his father was a slave. He was explaining to tell me the stories and stuff, and I would draw that. And it was like, wow, man, I just tell you stuff, and you just draw it. And I was, you know, I was just a good listener, and I enjoyed listening to the older people. But they always had some funny, something to tell you, some advice to give you, you know. So when the nighttime came, the grandfather was like, well, we all got to pray and just hope that our loved one survived the night. Because at the time, New Orleans it got real bad, you know, it got real bad. That crack came in and people turned to animals and savages, you know, in real life. You know, my uncle, he was a dope fiend, you know. He used drugs hot and heavy. He used crack, he used heroin, and he became a different person, you know. But we still loved him. We just didn't love his actions. We loved him, but we didn't love his actions. So my grandfather would school me on that. He said, you don't got to be like that. You don't have to let stuff like that take you over and make you act like that. So me as a child, I'm growing up to that. And then when I got older as an adult, I was like, well, I'm not getting into that life. I'm not selling no drugs. I'm going to high school. I'm going to college and play football. That's going to be it. As I finished playing football, I came back to New Orleans to work. And it was easy for me to go into that life and make all that money, whatever that was. I've been losing my soul. I probably had to kill somebody, or somebody had to kill me. Probably been locked up in the penitentiary, because that was our culture. That's what we was taught to do. You know, to follow the lead of the person who was running the project. You know, you taught if you can't make no money working, you had to make some money to support your family. And then my granddaddy, he said, look, man, I'd rather make a nickel than go to penitentiary and make a penny. That's what he used to tell me. So I just stayed out of trouble, man. I didn't want to be bothered with that. I knew about the nightlife. I just didn't entertain it. I knew about the hustlers and the dope dealers and the killers. I knew about those people. I didn't want to be dead in my world. I didn't want that to be my culture, you know. So I stuck to the art. I stuck to working. And then maybe a month before Katrina, I started drawing again. You know, I started just drawing to ease my little mind, because I was thinking about going into different things in life. Because I was starving. You know, I was starving. It didn't have too much. You know, he wasn't allowed to make too much. And then when I got into the artwork, I felt, you know, maybe let me give this a chance. I see if I'm consistent with this, I could be something. And then Katrina hit. She took out all my artwork I had, but she didn't take out my hope. I just kept on saying, that's all right. You can do it. And then I got back home to New Orleans in 2006. I started doing artwork in a FEMA trailer. And then that first year went by. That second year, I took the artwork to a frame shop on Bourbon Street in Orleans, a lady named Dawn. She told me, she said, look, I think you need to take this and show this to some galleries. I said, lady, I don't know about no galleries. I just want to keep a secret artwork. She said, well, look, if you want to give this away, you give me one, and I'll frame one for you. So I remember I went in with 20 works to get to the local high school that was open after Katrina, and she wound up getting 20 works from me, and I got the work framed. And then she was like, well, look, this is what you do. Go see this person to help you out. And then I remember I went to my aunt, Margaret Smith, and she told me a guy about a man named Jeffrey Cook. And Jeffrey Cook was working uptown on Aretha Kelly Hassel Street, and I went in there, and he saw the work, and he goes, man, this is special. What you going to do with this? I said, well, I don't know. I said, I don't know. I just want to try. You know, I don't want to go to penitentiary. He looked at me and said, you're right. You don't belong to penitentiary. He said, well, look, take this to the Bassett Gallery and let them look at it and see what's happening. But you keep in contact with me. So he became their uncle of mine. Because my uncle, he OD'd back in 2000, you know, from heroin. And so, you know, Jeffrey Cook became like an uncle figure to me. So I met Bassett Gallery. Bassett Gallery, he introduced me, and Dan Tippett, he introduced me to Dan Cameron. Dan Cameron was the international curator. He does biennials and stuff like that. So he introduced me me in prostate one. Then he put me in prostate
two. Dan Cameron put you in a prostate one biennial, you're saying. Yeah, go on.
Yeah.
That's what it was, right? Yeah.
Yeah, he put me in three of them. I was in prostate one, prostate 1.5, and prostate two. I did prostate three with Diego. So what happened when I met Dan Cameron, he said to me, he said, look, I think your work is blown outside of the South. And we said, you got to go other places where people could see the work. Now, me, I was like, well, whatever you want to do, man, I just do the work, and, you know, I give it to you. And he goes, wow, that's just beautiful. He said, some artists you can't get along with, but you, I can get along with you, Bruce. That's beautiful. So I said, all right. So we dealt with each other for like 3 years. We did Marfa, Texas. We did the Lambert Foundation in New York. We did the Jack Shannaman Gallery a couple of times. And so Dan Cameron introduced me to Jack Shannaman. But, you know, we didn't do no business together. But so when he did Prospect, Prospect 2, I met Diego Cortez, who Don Dudo at the time. And then Diego says, well, look, Bruce, I'm coming to New Orleans. I want to see what you got. So he came to my studio in New Orleans. And he looked at it. He agreed with it. He took half my work with him. And then, like, maybe 2 months later, he called me. He said, look, the Benetton had bought all the work he'd had for me. So he said, Bruce, we need an important collection. You know, so keep doing what you're doing. Don't stop. So me, I'm thinking, like, all right. It was nothing to me. You know, I wasn't excited or nothing. I was just happy that some people found me interested, you know. My grandfather always said, act like you always been there before. He said, don't act up. Don't show your hand. Always act like you've been there before. So it wasn't being cocky. It was just like, okay, all right, I'm supposed to be here, you know. But so after I dealt with Diego, he got me introduced to international affairs. We did London, Tokyo, Italy. We did that together. We did a lot of New York things together at the ASF Gallery. The Lucy James Gallery, the Fearman Gallery. We do stuff like that, you know. So it was like learning with Diego, with Dan Cameron, with Bashford, with Jeffrey Cook, about the art game. Because I didn't know nothing about the art game. I didn't know nothing about pricing. I didn't know nothing about sharing money with nobody. I didn't know nothing about talking to interviews with nobody. I was just green in a blade of grass, you know. But Diego said he'll never let nobody take advantage of it. You know, Dan Cameron said the same thing. Jeffrey Cook said the same thing. And they always protected me, you know. And I was able to just do the own work and get out the way, you know. That's all that was.
I see. So that's so much has happened right in that time. That's, you know, from you know, beginning to work to being in all of these shows. How did that change your sense of what you were making? You know, as your, you know, relative said, your community. You know, you've got something there, and suddenly now you know you really do have it. As you say, that, you know, the game is yours. That happened over these years, right? Something changed over those years.
Well, my thing was, I would just go do the artwork and get out the way. Whoever I was dealing with, selling the artwork or whatever gallery I was dealing with, let them handle the limelight, let them, you know, become famous. I just sit back and just collect the money. I didn't want to get in the way of the work. You know, sometimes as artists, we can get in the way of the work by personal problems, by what, drug habits, by social habits, by just, you know, being in the way. So I just did the work and just disappeared. So I let the people deal with the text that's in the work, let them deal with the name that's in the work. I let them deal with the culture of the work. I let them know about the village of the work. Then I hit them with certain things my grandparents and grandmother would say. Then I put rest in peace, different people names, Joe Louis, Muhammad Ali, Malcolm X, Betty Shabazz, Coretta Scott King. Because as a kid, you know, you grow up, you read books. And you read about those people, you know, and as I got older, you know, I found out more about those people. I just want to put them in the artwork, you know, sometimes a boxer fan might be the biggest art collector. Sometimes the biggest basketball player might be an art collector. So that's what I did. You know, my thing was to do the artwork and just get out the way, you know, just take whatever ideas I get into my mind, take it and put it on the paper. That's all it was. And get out the way.
I like it. That's good advice for all artists. I want to thank you for talking to me today, and really wish you well on the show coming up. It's a great show. I hope the listeners get to see it. There's links here so they can learn more. I want to thank you so much, Dapper. Really, really enjoyed talking with you. And good luck on the show. Because the game is yours.
Yes, sir. Well, what it is, I haven't shown in New York in 5 years. Last time I showed in New York, it was at the Fearman Gallery in 2019. And so every year since 2010, I had showed in New York. You know, but in 5 years, I haven't been showing in New York in a while. So now I'm back in New York, and I plan to stay in New York with the artwork, keep on doing it so I can stay there. But I found a good gallery through another friend of mine. And in this gallery, that gives me a free reign to create what I want to create and to do what I want to do, and they let me do that. They remind me of Diego, because Diego used to let me do what I want to do with the artwork, and he was like a father figure to me. I used to call him Pimp Daddy. Him and Don Dudo, Don Dudo introduced me to Diego. I called her my pimp mother. So in this art gang, I have parents in it. Diego was my pimp daddy. Don Dudo was my pimp mother. Andy and Tippett and Jeffrey Cook was my uncles in the art game. Dan Cameron was like an uncle in the art game. Clementine Hunter, like a grandmother in the art game. Ernie Burns, like an uncle in the art game. Most people like that I look up to and I keep going. Even Bob Ross, he's like an uncle of mine. Watch him too, And he helped me with this art. But it's not just me, It's a higher calling dealing with me that I got to deal with this artwork. Because if not, I'll probably be hooked up with the devil, man, being penitentiary or dead, So with this art, I'm able to survive. I'm able to provide for a daughter and keep it going. So my daughter, she's 8, and she does art, She said, Daddy, you're a superstar. I see you. I Google you, and I see you're a superstar. And I said, okay, now I'm going to make you a superstar. And she goes, no. I said, yes, indeed, I'll make you a superstar. That's what that is, man. That's what that is. God has been good to me, and I'm able to do the art. It just comes out, man. I look at the art after I finish with it, and I go, I did that. I step away from it because, it's just not just me. And it's just not me that I'm providing for. I'm providing for the next 2 generations. I want my daughter's grandchildren to be able to eat off what I do, Like Picasso, I want that to happen for me and mine, That's what that is. And then also I donate to the high school bands, marching bands, but that's my subject. Diego always said, if you take care of your subject will take care of you. So I make sure every so many years I donate to the high school bands in about 9 or 10 different states, just because there's some artists don't do that. I want to be that artist and do that, deal with his subject and get back to his subject and protect his subject and preserve his subject. So in the next 2 generations to understand that subject and love that subject as much as I did.
Thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me, brother.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.